Turn off pagers and cell phones so that the council aren't troubled or bothered during their oral argument. And with that request, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. It's not a products liability case. That's basically the sum and substance of our argument as put forth in the breach. This is a garden variety breach of warranty. We're not saying that the car he bought burst into flames, it didn't kill anyone, it didn't set his house on fire. We're not claiming the toaster electrocuted someone. We're just saying it doesn't make toast and we want to return it. Under Colorado law, diminution in value is a remedy for a breach of warranty claim. It's a simple breach of implied warranty. And I think the district court misapplied or misread what the claim is or what the argument is on that. And I think the General Assembly might have gone a little far when they tried to fix the statute by saying, however you may want to couch your claim. Because obviously there's a history on products liability. That statute's been amended a couple of times, because every time they would amend it, they say, well, if we don't go for a strict liability standard, we can still bring this in under a products liability or a breach of implied warranty claim. So I think the General Assembly might have gone overboard, or they didn't.
Say they might have gone overboard, are you meaning it's unconstitutional? Because normally we don't make decisions about whether we think the scope of what the legislature does is wise or not.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't think they chose their words carefully when they said, no matter how you may couch the claim, you know, when they said it's a, you can't bring, they established the innocent seller defense. And they say, no matter how you plead the claim, essentially. And the district court, I think, read that too broadly, and I believe opposing counsel read that too broadly. It's not a products liability case. We're not bringing it in under a strict liability standard. It's just a garden variety breach of warranty. The car's no good. It was in the shop a lot. Want our money back.
Do you contend that the legislature's language is clear or ambiguous?
I think under the definition section, they could have been a little bit more precise in defining what a products liability claim is. As I stated in the brief, a breach of warranty claim can sound in both contract and tort. And this is basically a UCC contract claim.
So is this a long way of saying it's ambiguous? Because if it is, then my question is, well, what does the legislative history, if any, say about that?
I don't know it's ambiguous. That's going back to the point I was making with Judge Miller, is I think they reacted to, they tried to establish some kind of safe ground for retailers, okay, or, you know, retailers, wholesalers, whoever introduced the market, if they don't have any hand in manufacturing, designing, or what have you. And lawyers, plaintiffs' lawyers, wily as we may be, when they said, okay, you can't do it this way, they, you know, you build a better mousetrap. And that's what happened. So I think when they came back and they added, no matter what kind of claim, forgive me, I don't have the exact language, but when they put the catch-all in, I think it was overly broad. I don't know that it's ambiguous. I just think they maybe could have defined products liability a little bit better to keep us being out of here. But I don't think they intended to basically tear a page out of the UCC and say there is no more breach of implied warranty of merchantability.
Ask you another question. The trial judge in her order said explicitly, you know, you got other remedies. You could have sued under the Colorado Lemon Law statute.
We did.
Well, you didn't sue Brighton Ford under that.
You can't sue Brighton Ford.
Well, that's what I'm asking. So why not?
Because it's against the Lemon Law is against the manufacturer.
Only?
Yes. Because they supply the warranty.
You're saying there's an implied warranty.
Right. They supply the express warranty. And then along with any sale goes an implied warranty of merchantability. And that comes from the retailer.
So was the trial judge wrong that you could have filed a Lemon Law claim?
Yes, she was.
Okay.
That's basically the sum and substance of our argument, Judge. I believe it's all in the brief. I just cannot see how this is a products liability case or how the statute is applicable. Do you have any other questions?
Mr. Winkup, I've got several questions.
Yes, sir.
As I understand, the Supreme Court of the United States in the East River SS Corporation against Transamerica, the situation where a product simply injures itself is relegated to the claim based upon a breach of warranty, and it's not a product liability case.
Correct.
However, the Heigl case okay. in Colorado seems to say that even where a product injures just itself and there is no personal injury attributed to the defect, that can be a product's liability claim. It seems to be just the opposite of the East River SS Corporation case. But in Town of Alma, our Supreme Court cites the East River SS Corporation case with approval, indicating to me that our Supreme Court recognizes that at least the United States Supreme Court's position that where a product simply injures itself, it is not a product liability claim, but that has some legs. That is a reasonable position. But the Supreme Court in Town of Alma also cites Heigl with what I suppose can be said is approval. So here we are left with, it seems to me to be a rather unenviable position of trying to balance the East River approach to products liability claims versus the Heigl case to products liability case, or to products liability claims, on the one hand, with what seems to be the legislative declaration in Colorado that doesn't make any difference whether it's a products liability claim or not, all claims, regardless of the theory upon which they're based, are products liability claims for purposes of the Innocent Seller Act. Your brief doesn't help me on this analysis, quite frankly, but I'm interested in your response to it.
Well, I think one of the maxims of statutory interpretation has to be you can't interpret a statute which would lead to an absurd result. Had the legislature intended that we no longer have a breach of implied warranty of merchantability, which always runs to a seller, I mean, that's the seller's warranty. If they had intended that, they certainly could have revoked the statute, or maybe they should have put some language in that says this doesn't affect 314 claims.
Your point is well taken, and it's one that has bothered me. I phrase it a bit differently, and that is when the legislature repeals another scheme, another statutory scheme, isn't it required to expressly tell you that?
Yes.
And isn't the effect, if we look at the definition of products liability claims here under the Innocent Seller Act, isn't the effect really to repeal huge portions of the Uniform Commercial Code?
Exactly. And I don't think we can read into 402 that they just wanted to take a broadsword to the UCC. And nowhere have they declared that. I mean, this is clearly limited to a products liability situation where you have, and they have the definitions, life, injury, or property damage. And we're not saying that, again, the car burst into flames and burnt down a house, which is, one of the cases cited by appellee. I understand the court's concern about damage to its own self as far as the car, but it's not even that kind of case. I mean, the car didn't, you know, catch fire. Okay, there wasn't an inoperable part in the car, an electrical malfunction or something that set the entire car on fire.
It just doesn't work.
It just doesn't work. Yeah, I mean, it was just in the shop a lot. So again, the measure of damages on an implied warranty claim is diminution in value. We're not saying that car was an instrument that caused damage somewhere else to either property, people, or, you know, or, you know, death.
However, if I adopt Ms. Valerio's position, it seems to me that the innocent seller statute is so broad that if I buy a lawnmower and it doesn't cut grass, I can't take it back to the seller.
Correct. And that's essentially what I was saying before. We're not saying the toaster burnt down the house. We're just trying to take the toaster back to Sears.
So isn't the focus on Section 1321.401.2, the definition of product liability action, and the question then is whether when something just doesn't work, does that constitute property damage? And you're saying it does not.
Right.
By the way, does the there was a Magnuson Moss warranty claim. Was that also dismissed by the court's order, a federal claim?
The Mag Moss claim is kind of an umbrella claim for a breach of implied warranty or express warranty that allows for the recovery of attorney's fees. So Mag Moss is essentially a breach of implied warranty claim.
So it was dismissed?
Correct. It's all gone. The manufacturer's out of business. You know, the case is dismissed. It's, you know, it's been a mess. But yeah, all the cases are dismissed.
Well, for purposes of the Magnuson Moss warranty claims, do we assume that that they are based upon the state's interpretation of what a product's liability claim is or is not?
It is, Your Honor. The Magnuson Moss warranty claim or warranty act specifically references that each state's in particular warranty law is applicable to the claim brought.
So there's no preemption issue here?
No, it's actually deferential to state warranty law. I have about 3 minutes that I'll reserve unless you have further questions.
All right, Mr. Renko.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Christina Valerio, registration number 36754, and I represent Appalee Brighton Ford Incorporated. Brighton Ford is precisely the type of entity that the Colorado legislature intended to protect when it enacted Article 13, Title 21, Section 402, entitled the Innocent Seller Statute.
So excuse me for interrupting, but so the legislature intended that all sellers in the state of Colorado would have absolute immunity regardless of the shoddiness or non-workability of the products they sell?
The Colorado legislature intended when the seller took no part in the manufacture of a product and the consumer could go after the manufacturer of that product, then yes, innocent sellers would be protected in cases where there were property damage.
So the example that So the example I gave to Mr. Winkoop is absolutely right. If I buy a lawnmower and it won't cut grass, I'm out of luck. I can't take it back to the seller.
Well, if you can go after John Deere for it, then yes, you can't go after Home Depot.
Why on earth would I ever buy a lawnmower from anybody unless I bought it online? I mean, it isn't the result of this that you just don't want to buy anything from a local seller.
Well, I believe that the result of this is that if you have a manufacturer which puts defective products into the stream of commerce, then why should even Home Depot be responsible for those 10,000 defective lawnmowers, or even that one defective lawnmower, if it eventually should go back to John Deere?
Because now, they have the franchise to sell the goods, and they're taking the risk in a capital market to stand behind the products they sell.
Well, let's look at a different situation, a Bob's lawnmower company, and he sells individual lawnmowers, and he sells, I don't even know if John Deere makes lawnmowers, but he sells 100 John Deere lawnmowers, and all of them are defective, and John Deere says, I'm sorry, you're responsible for that. The Colorado legislature, whether or not we as consumers think that this is the right way to go about it, was very clear in its language. It said that a product liability action, which was one in which the manufacturer, design, or installation of a product caused property damage.
What's the property damage?
Well, I have two answers to that question. The first being that here we have a unique situation. We have a Saline Extreme Mustang. So what that is that Ford sends a Mustang shell to Saline, and Saline then puts aftermarket products on it, including the engine, a differential, exhaust system, stickers, gauges. They give the car a souped up appearance and performance. They take a $30,000 Mustang shell and churn it into an $80,000 Saline Extreme Mustang. So you have two different manufacturers, two different express warranties, and you have Mr. Carter alleging that the whole vehicle is unfit for his purpose and he wants to revoke his acceptance to that vehicle. So in effect, the Saline defective parts are damaging the property, which is the Ford Mustang shell. So we do have that unique situation here. If the court is having some trouble and, like you said, feels that it's in an unenviable situation with Town of Alma and Heigl and that.
But wouldn't you have that in literally every situation in a retail sale where maybe one part was manufactured by one manufacturer and then it gets placed by the more general manufacturer? I mean, it seems to me that happens in a huge amount of time. So why does that necessarily distinguish this case?
Well, I'm thinking of my client specifically, but generally Brighton Ford sells Ford products manufactured, designed by Ford, but they have the rare case where they ship that off to another manufacturer with a wholly different warranty.
But it doesn't make any difference, really, under your theory, whether the Saline parts are defective. If he had bought just a regular Mustang and the Mustang turned out to be just wasn't an automobile, as the purchaser thinks it should be, mm-hmm. Brighton Ford's still an innocent seller.
That's correct, Your Honor. Brighton Ford is still an innocent seller. The Colorado legislature was very clear in its language. It says a product liability action, regardless of the substantive legal theory upon which that action is brought. I mean, that's very clear, broad language.
Well, let me talk about that a little bit. I'm still focused, as Judge Miller was, on the question of what's the product damage here? And is it your contention that those words are crystal clear and not ambiguous? Because we, as Judge Graham said, we seem to have cases going both ways.
I think that the language, regardless of the substantive legal theory brought, is clear and unambiguous.
No matter what the subsequent legal theory is, it's still, you still have to, for it to be a product liability case, there's either got to be personal injury or there's got to be product damage. So why is this product damage, and why isn't that at a minimum ambiguous?
Your Honor, so we have Section 401, which was enacted in 1977, and it says that a product liability action must include property damage. I don't know of any Colorado case law which definitively says in an implied warranty action it has to be to the product itself or to some other property. And obviously we have Heigl and Alma, where in the Alma court did approve of Heigl, which to me would let us say that the damage doesn't have to be to the property itself, or excuse me, to the product, just the product. I had that right the first time. The damage doesn't have to be to other property. We also have the Lowridge case, Lowridge versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. And in that case, in 2002, before this statute was even enacted, Judge Babcock held that breach of implied warranty claims are based on product liability. And what Judge Babcock was analyzing there was a UCC breach of implied warranty claim, and he was looking at Section 401.
There was damage in that case. Here, you've constructed a little theory whereby one might say that the shell was somehow damaged by the saline products. That wasn't pled in the complaint. Nobody said that any of the shell of the Ford car was damaged by anything saline did. They just said, we got a car that doesn't work, and they want their money back.
In the record, and I'm happy to provide the record sites, Mr. Carter alleges that the parts that were defective, all of those parts, were saline parts. And as far as damaging the Ford shell, that is a jump we'd have to make, because Mr. Carter alleges that the exhaust system would bang up against the car, and that's why the car was damaged. It's banging up against the shell, which is the car. Also, it was that something happened within the differential. There was a smell, and so he didn't want to drive the entire car. So, I mean, so there is case law, such as 10th Circuit case law, U.S. Aviation, when an aircraft and an engine both had separate warranties, the court there refused to apply the economic loss doctrine and ruled that the tort claims would stand. And also, they talked about how when the loss was to the entire aircraft itself, rather than just to the warrantied parts, they did not want to limit the action to those under the warranties. Here, the innocent seller doctrine should not be limited, because Mr. Carter is asserting that the product was damaged because, in effect, the entire vehicle is damaged. He's not trying to revoke his acceptance to just those saline defective parts.
Let me ask you a question. You said the innocent seller doctrine, but what we really have here is a statute. The question is, and this doesn't seem to be covered in the briefs, and so that may answer the question, but do other states have a statute like our innocent seller statute? And if so, are there cases out there that have gone through the interpretive issue that we're facing right here? Do you know?
I don't know, Your Honor. I have not seen any in my manuscript.
You're not suggesting, get back to Loughridge for just a moment, you're not suggesting we have to follow 10th Circuit cases?
No, Your Honor. That Loughridge is a District of Colorado.
And in Heigl, the problem in Heigl represented a substantial risk of harm to the owner of the truck. The wheels, unless they were torqued properly, would fall off, and falling off on the highway, it not only represented a risk of harm to the owner or driver of the truck, it represented a risk of harm to the traveling public. And the court there adopted the restatement, which is a strict products liability tort. I have a tough time taking Heigl and converting it into a principle of law that says when you have a defective product that just doesn't work, that's product damage for purposes of making it a products liability claim.
Your Honor, that is correct. In Heigl, there was risk to the general public for the chassis falling off the motorhome. I'm sure here you could argue that the smoke coming out of the car, Mr. Carter said he was really scared of the car. Maybe there was damage, fear for the public itself there as well. But also, I think we have to get back to the statute, because the statute is not ambiguous.
And that's exactly where I was going to go. Thank you for taking me back there. It seems to me that certainly one principle we need to follow is we can't interpret a statute so as to reach an absurd result. And if we interpret the statute the way you want us to interpret it here, it seems to me the two things happen. Number one, we abrogate a huge chunk of the Uniform Commercial Code. And number two, we have a situation where the seller is not responsible for any product at any time, regardless of whether there's property damage or not. If the product doesn't work, it's not only not damaged, it just doesn't work. If I buy the stapler from Staples and it doesn't staple, the seller is not responsible for it under your theory of the innocent seller statute.
I have three parts to that answer, if you don't mind. One just being that I do think that this is the unique situation where we have parts warranted and manufactured by one entity and then put on another Ford Mustang shell. So we have that unique situation in our case. But two, we have that the second part of Section 402 warrants, and this was not brought up by Mr. Wynkoop. It was not, I wouldn't say that he could raise it as a defense here, but when you cannot obtain jurisdiction over the seller, or excuse me, the manufacturer, then you can go after the seller. So there is a remedy for people that can't get what is due to them from the manufacturer. And third, regarding the UCC, that was enacted in 1963, and we have to assume that the Colorado legislature had full knowledge of those statutes when it amended this one.
Well, but let me ask you this same question I asked Mr. Wynkoop. When the legislature acts in a way that repeals another statutory scheme, don't they have to expressly say that?
Exactly.
Can they do that by implication?
No, Your Honor, they have to be clear, but here what they said was that when you have a product liability action, which sounds in contract or in tort or regardless of the theory upon which it's brought, then an innocent seller is protected. There are multiple other sections of the UCC which still apply. I don't think that the legislature was unclear here. I mean, they took out the language about strict liability in tort. They took out that limiting language based on the doctrine of strict liability in tort. If they had just left in tort in, then apparently we could go with Mr. Wynkoop's argument, but they didn't. They were clear, and they said regardless of the theory. So I would argue that unless they put an exception or an inclusion in the statute, then we have to follow that language.
It does have in the language, and again, I think that, as I expressed to Mr. Wynkoop, I think it turns on the other preceding section, but in the section you're quoting from, the last sentence says, nothing in this Part 4 shall be construed to limit any other action from being brought against any seller of a product. What are the other actions that could be brought?
Just as Judge Delgado mentioned in her order, those are for lemon law actions, which I can discuss. I can discuss whether or not you think those are proper here. I don't know if you want to talk about that, Judge Loeb. But fraud claims, CCPA claims, all of those types of actions.
Why not? Why wouldn't you say UCC claims or breach of contract claims?
Well, they didn't, though. And so we have to interpret the language that we're given. And they didn't make an exception for those UCC claims.
It was in the last sentence.
So is Your Honor asking if I think nothing in this Part 4 shall be any other action includes UCC claims?
You obviously do think it excludes UCC claims. And I'm not sure how you're drawing the line as to what's included and what isn't. Why wouldn't a claim of fraud, if it involves property damage, and not be a products liability claim under your theory?
Because, Your Honor, there are many cases and many situations where a breach of implied warranty is considered a product liability action. There aren't many cases where a fraud claim is considered a product liability action. We're not reaching out that far. We're just saying it doesn't matter whether this sounds in contract or in tort. It is a product liability, and it caused property damage. So all of the elements of the definition in Section 401 are met. I see that I'm out of time. Are there any other questions? Brayton Ford respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Valerio.
You're welcome.
Mr. Wynkoop, you've got 2 minutes and 51 seconds.
And, Your Honors, I really don't have a whole lot to add, but I think it would be important for the court to look at what the legislature was trying to do with this innocent seller statute. Say you've got Jim's Toaster Shop. and Jim sells toasters. And he knows he sells a bad toaster, he might have to take back the $15 toaster. What he doesn't expect is he sells a bad toaster, which electrocutes little Jimmy, and now Jim's toaster shop's getting hit for a $20 million lawsuit. And I think that's the situation that the legislature was trying to address with this statute. Is it's an allocation of risk versus, you know, he has to take a bad toaster back when he buys one. And that's really what we're talking about here.
How do we know that from the language of the statute? You may be absolutely right, but under rules of statutory interpretation, if the language is clear, we're done. We end our analysis. So my question is, if that's why I was asking all these questions about, is it ambiguous or is it clear? Because if it's ambiguous, we could go to the legislative history and we could say, okay, now I get what they were trying to do. But that's nowhere in either of the briefs.
It is, but I think we can certainly read into it that's the harm they were trying to prevent is, you know, a business gets hit with a disproportionate share of liability based on something they didn't manufacture or sell. I mean, I think that's just common sense. But I don't think they were trying to say that, you know, a manufacturer doesn't have to stand behind their product. I don't think they're trying to rewrite the UCC to insert caveat emptor in, you know, every transaction. I have nothing further unless the court has some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rinkoop. Thank you again, Ms. Lario. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our docket for this afternoon, and the bailiff may announce a recess.
Court will be in recess, subject to call.